Greetings, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Today, I'm excited to have one of my favorite guests return to the show, Dr. Carmen Bolter. Carmen is the director, producer, and writer of the award-winning DVD, The Pyramid Code. Her five-part, two-DVD set has been aired in 27 countries and is scheduled to air in 26 more around the world. She is also the author of Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. To find out more, go to her website at www.pyramidcode.com. With a lifetime of scientific research and teaching as a professor at the University of Calgary under her belt, Carmen is one of the most knowledgeable scholars on Egypt alive today. She just returned from, I think, her 28th guided trip to Egypt with a group to directly experience the higher frequencies in the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx on the magical date of 11-11-11. In addition, she is currently hosting the powerful online course, The Evolver Intensive. Carmen's course is called Unlocking the Pyramid Code, Ancient Egypt as a Model for Empowerment. It's an in-depth exploration of the masterful abilities of the ancient Egyptians that can be activated within us and the technology for free energy that we are on the verge of rediscovering. She brings world-class guests such as Robert Bovall, Laird Scranton, Walter Cruttendon, John Anthony West, and the two upcoming guests, which are Christopher Dunn and William Henry, to your living room live to share their presentations, ideas, wisdom, and to answer questions directly. This is one of the most exciting new forms of media online, and I highly encourage those with an interest to check out the next guest and register at www.evolverintensives.com. You will find me there also, so come on board, the water's fine. So now it's my great pleasure to welcome Carmen back to the show. Hi, Carmen, how are you?
I'm great. Hi, Lance, how are you?
Good. Well, you know, I imagine that the last time we spoke, you were getting ready to do the trip to Egypt for the 11-11-11 group, and I'm guessing that everybody's probably pretty excited to share your experiences during your most recent trip, which you've returned from, that includes the date 11-11-11 and 12, and what happened during your recent trip. And did you notice any dramatic shift in the energies upon arriving with your group?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've been going to Egypt since 1977, and the post-Mubarak Egypt definitely has a different sense to it. The people are empowered in a new way. It's certainly not what CNN is asking people to think of Egypt and promoting all this fear and, you know, upsets at Tahrir Square. The people really feel like they've given themselves a voice. And then the energy seems to be spreading. So being a little bit farther away from the pyramid, you still feel the good energy from there. So I used to spend a lot of time inside the body of the Sphinx and, you know, have a certain energetic signature, if you will, of what that was. And this time when I was there at the Meridian, I could feel it at the hotel beside the pool. So I was very, very impressed with the unified field and how strong the energy was.
Wonderful. That's really good news. Of course, it would be even better if that energy expanded outwards and encompassed all of us here in the dark densities in the United States. But, you know, we have 2012 in front of us, so perhaps that's on the agenda.
It's right in front of us. Any minute, 2012.
By the time this is heard, it'll be heard tonight, but we got a couple of days?
A couple of days, and then we're in 2012. It's not the galactic alignment. But the other thing is that we've just had winter solstice, 2011, and the galactic alignment was also happening the other day, not exactly on, but close enough to give us some of that energy. But I do think that the energy is still stronger in Egypt than it is over here.
Oh, yeah, I would think. And you probably, being so tuned to these to those energies, feel it in the airplane as you're flying over.
Well, I certainly experienced the loss of it coming home. And, You know, and it even feels funny to call this home, because I really do feel more at home in Egypt. So
right.
This is a much denser field here. And once you've experienced that magical, refined energy, it's really hard to deal with the density. But it's still over there, and I can still access it on the etherics. Once we understand what the energy is, I think we can go back and get a little taste of it again.
Yes, yes. And I know that you're planning a trip on 12-12-12, so people will have an opportunity to join you at that time, and I think that's going to be a really powerful experience. Not that this one wasn't, but, I mean, don't you think that the energies, you've been doing this for quite a few years now on these magical dates, numerologically.
Yeah, I've been leading tours to Egypt since 1996, and I would find alignments like planetary conjunctions and equinoxes and that sort of thing to always make a special, wrap the trip around special dates. But I did one 10-10-10, and then, as you said, 11-11-11, and now 12-12-12. So I believe that those three dates are ascension portals,
mm-hmm.
and there's a tremendous amount of interest in this next trip, and I think that people don't care if CNN is saying that it's scary over there. People want to come. And I'm really happy about that, because even though there's lots of opportunities to swim in fear soup, I think that there's quite a few people who are like, I'm just not going there.
Right.
And that's how we're going to create a new world, by not succumbing to the invitation to be afraid.
Absolutely. And, you know, so many people have basically proven beyond any rational doubt at the scientific level and the quantum field that fear contracts the DNA, and emotions that are loving and compassionate and away from fear actually unravel it, and it forms a ladder. Do you notice many synchronicities with the idea of an evolving ladder and spiral and the caduceus that are there at the pyramids?
Well, yes, the energetics. I mean, this whole idea of DNA and also getting this strands of DNA reactivated, because we had 12-strand DNA in the Golden Age,
mm-hmm.
way back when, 12,000 years ago, and then we were knocked down to 2. And
yeah.
so there really is an evolution going from 2 to 3 to 6 to 9 to 12. And we actually take ourselves there through consciousness and awareness, and I think through plugging in to sacred sites and experiencing these higher levels of energy, and also through cellular memory, that somehow we can work our way back. And with the 12-strand DNA and a fully active pineal gland, we really do have access to abilities that the ancients had that have been far-fetched and kind of mythological to us in this day and age, but it's becoming available to us again.
Yes, yes, wonderful. And so many people are waking up in the world. Of course, it can't be fast enough for those of us who are, you know, just a nanosecond ahead of the crowd, but people are waking up and finding that they're really not happy in their jobs and their careers and the material pursuits that have been kind of distracting us from the more esoteric and spiritual inner planes. So it seems that this is a wonderful year for people to step out of their perceived roles and belief systems and open up to some of these ideas and energies that are very tangible and real.
They are very tangible and real, and people are becoming more telepathic. We really are, as a collective, waking up. It's quite impressive. There's still a lot of people that are getting pulled down from whatever, TV and pharmaceuticals and fluoride in the water and those sorts of things, but there are plenty of people that are rising above it all as well.
Absolutely. You know, I've noticed a big shift since I started drinking distilled water to clear out the pineal gland in my body from the fluoride and the various other dozens of things that are in it that you don't taste or see. And so I'm actively, and all my friends are actively doing this, to remove the harmful inorganic materials, and we're opening up to this more subtle realms. And I think that's kind of a conscious choice that we all have to make. You know, what do we want to experience here during our time, and what can we give when we're dumbed down and, you know, kept in a box? So,
yeah.
I don't want to get off on a tangent here because it would be very easy to do. So maybe we could continue with what happened on 11/11. I know that there were some difficulties with that, and it turned out to be a triumphant experience. What did go on with your group?
Well,
over
we
there?
Had permits secured with the Supreme Council of Antiquities to go into the Great Pyramid at 1:30 in the morning, just a few hours into 11/11, and our permits were confirmed about 6 hours prior to that, and then suddenly we got a call that said that the Great Pyramid was going to be closed for 24 hours and no one was going to get in. And so, of course, a few people's egos got in the way, and everybody was, you know, kind of panicking that, you know, they had been promised this, and the military had shut it down, which I thought was incredibly ironic because the energy was so switched on, and you don't have to be standing inside the Great Pyramid to feel it. And so, I mean, I kind of just shrugged and thought, well, you can't turn the energy off. You can close the pyramid, but go right ahead and close the pyramid. So it's like, to me, it was kind of like locking the barn after the horse has been stolen, that the energy's with us. You stand us anywhere along the Band of Peace where the pyramid fields are. And so a few minutes later, those of you who have seen the Pyramid Code probably remember the indigenous wisdom keeper, Hakim, who passed on.
Wow.
But his son appeared like 15 minutes later.
Wow.
The bus stopped and he got on. And then I was talking to him and I said, well, the military shut the pyramid down. He says, well, you want to go to Abu Ghraib to the crystal altar? I can help you do that. I'm like, okay. So to me, being outside, and it was full moon that night. So the idea of being outside in the warmth, because even though it's winter there, it's still very warm, and being at the crystal altar of Abu Ghraib was just a dream, and the light was so bright from the moon.
Wow.
And we had a harpist with us.
Wow.
And she had brought a small portable harp, and so she sat off in the distance. And at the end of the ceremony, I went over to her, and there was someone else sitting next to her, and I said, are we in heaven? And the woman said, I think we might be. You know, so it was just like unbelievable to be outside. And every other time, which is numerous, that I've been to the crystal altar, it's been during the day. And there's a 6-foot laser cut circle that you can lie down on. And it's almost like getting, you know, being in an oven, being baked by the sun. So there was something about the magnetic energy of the full moonlight that was just magical.
Wow.
So then we were allowed to go and do what we were planning on doing on 11/11 on 2011.
Oh.
So November 20th, we got to go into the Great Pyramid, and that was just absolutely fabulous because the group was a little bit more aware because we had been inside a few other pyramids about how footsteps resonate and make thundering sounds, and so how important it was to just get in there, situate ourselves, and meditate or tone a little bit and feel the resonance. And so, you know, there were people who achieved a harmonic resonance in there that totally changed them. And we've done some experiments in the Great Pyramid looking at the effect on the photonic emissions from the body in terms of how the pyramid affects the human aura, and did like a baseline outside the pyramid away from the plateau. And then in the pyramid, and then a delayed post-test. And it really does permanently affect the energy field of the body. And so, I mean, I'm so impressed with that. And then we got a full 2 hours at sunset between the paws of the Sphinx. And there happens to be three cavities that you can go into in the Sphinx. And usually you're not allowed to get anywhere close to them. And not everyone in the group, but a good number of people got to go in these other chambers. So there's the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx, and there's one at the left back rump and the hip, and that's 3 stories high.
Wow.
And it was wide open. We got to photograph the whole thing.
Wow.
And then there's another one on the right elbow. And then when we were there, the sound and light show started, and we got to take awesome pictures of the Sphinx and the pyramids lit up, and it was just like magical. Like,
oh my gosh.
Incredible that we got to do it. So all these things that I've been able to do on my own through various, you know, getting permits and various privileges that who knows how it all happens, the whole group got to experience.
So
I'm very enthused about how that went. And I watched it change people who didn't necessarily, you know, tune in that much, were just getting boosts of energy, and their understanding synchronicity and how to create, you know, and how to manifest and really understanding this energy and what it can actually do to improve our abilities. It's incredible.
Wow. Well, speaking of that, there are so many people that have their own slant on how to manifest and intent and consciousness and the rest of it. What is your take on that?
Well, first of all, and as much as The Secret was a powerful thing, I think that it misled people a little bit when, the idea that, you know, if you want something, you can create it. And so if you want a new red car, then you can manifest that. But I don't think the point of manifestation in terms of high-level initiates had anything to do with the lower self.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, like lots of people say, well, I want $1 million in my bank account, so put it there already.
Right.
But that's not what it's about. It's about the lower self surrendering to the higher self.
Yes.
Fields within fields within fields, creating an energetic harmonic, and then literally being able to pull things from another dimension into the physical.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a, it was done in the past. It was done in groups, and if something landed in your hand, doesn't mean it's yours. And if you said, "Well, I want this," and you took it, then you couldn't manifest anymore.
Right.
So it really is about a higher good, for the good of all humanity, for a spiritual purpose, not for a personal purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you need a car to be going and doing service, then spirit could manifest a car for you, and if you prefer red, you can say, pick a red one. But it's not about, I want it for my own ego.
Right.
Right? So, so manifestation is tricky business, and, and it's, most people aren't that oriented to being an instrument of service for the higher good of all.
That's right.
But that's the best game in town, if you ask me.
Yes, yes. I totally agree with you. And I know you have a greater awareness of the initiation process of the mystery schools and the priestesses that used to, because it was the divine feminine or the feminine aspect that was really empowering during the high time of the Golden Age. Can you talk about that a little bit, too?
Sure. It wasn't like matriarchal times meant that the women dominated the men.
Right.
As the imbalanced patriarchy, the men do dominate, and the masculine principle has all but erased feminine consciousness in our times.
Mm-hmm.
So in my recollection of cellular memory, past life memory, from the Golden Age in Egypt was that there was a balance between the masculine and the feminine, and the feminine was trained separately from the masculine, and then the energy would come together and make a charge.
Mm-hmm.
And so the initiates were trained. They started at the base chakra. They'd work their way up the Nile at a different temple, representing a different energetic, representing a different chakra, which was connected to a gland. So the whole thing about the ancient initiates and the wisdom of ancient Egypt was that it was a system of stimulating the glandular system, which is hormonal, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But it led to a certain amount of prowess and clearing through the fears, the various chakras. And instead of it being like sexuality and you know, using up energy through stimulation, I suppose, it was more of a harnessing of energy and sex magic. And so it started the base chakra at the Temple of Isis, and it went up, you know, and then you confront your fears, Kamumbo, various temples, names that may be familiar to people who have been to Egypt or have studied it. And then they would work their way to the crown chakra, which is the plateau, the band of peace. And after an initiate would arrive there, they would be there forever. They'd arrive bare feet, blindfolded, naked, and they'd be given a robe, and they'd stay there forever, and the whole thing was telepathic. But they could work their way through the 8 levels of initiation through dietary practices, through meditation, through discipline and study.
Wow.
At the 9th level, they had to literally be lifted into it by being plugged into the high priestess that would elevate their energetic system to a point where then they would receive these abilities. And so telepathy seems to be the most basic one, and manifestation would come, and then alchemy, bilocation, teleportation, and I always forget one when I'm doing my list of 6. But It's funny. No matter where I start, there's one I leave out.
Walking between worlds, like this.
Yeah, right. But this whole idea of the transmutation of the atom, and our bodies are mostly water, and so there was a power system that was happening. The water would flood from the Nile. The Nile used to run right in front of the pyramids at the foot of the Sphinx, and it's migrated now 8 miles. It would fill up these honeycomb chambers all the way underneath the plateau, and it would build the charge, and then the water molecule would be blasted apart to hydrogen and oxygen, and then that would create a source of a passive implosion source of non-polluting power that was free.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our bodies are made out of water mostly as well. And so the transmutation of the atom within our bodies is what creates these abilities, which creates the ability to learn how to do these things. And so it seems far-fetched and it seems like science fiction to many people.
Mm-hmm.
However, we're all fascinated with that, which is why so many movies and TV series are showing people with various abilities. So it really was training for the high-level initiates. I think that they were selected much like in China and in Russia, they'll go and they'll go to a school with kindergarten students and pick who might be a gymnast or a ballerina or a figure skater and train them. So I think that high-level initiates perhaps, you know, had gifts already, the children who would become initiates may have indicated a certain amount of orientation to that. It certainly wasn't for everybody, but it served a function, and it connected to a worldwide grid. It wasn't just Egypt. And it was like food, emotional, spiritual food for the whole planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it came through the high-level initiates, who I liken to human divining rods.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that when you lift your hand up, the neural synapses don't touch, the signal goes from the brain. It's actually a hormone that jumps across and allows you to raise your arm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the human divining rod means that in order for the cosmic energy to get grounded into the Earth, it would pass through the whole system of the high-level initiates, and for the telluric Earth energy to go up into the cosmos, it's almost like they were part of the circuitry.
Mm.
And that's why the whole thing about the hormones and the body being particularly healthy and being able to handle huge charges of energy was all part of what they were doing, which is why they had to be really well-trained, or else they would get what I call electromagneticuted, which is a word I invented.
Oh.
Instead of electrocuted, because it was magnetic energy, they could get overcharged.
Oh, okay.
And it actually could kill them if they weren't trained properly, which is why all this is so important.
Yes, yes. There have been instances of people spontaneously burning up or exploding, which is another phenomenon, but... So it does take time for those energies to be grounded in us, and with the interference waves that we are presently experiencing, which you refer to as the density of coming home, you know, electricity and all the artificial constructs that we have, it seems that we're being rewired in the wrong direction. So free energy existed tens of thousands of years ago, and we are coming up on another, theoretically, we're coming up on another beginning of the Golden Age, are we not?
Well, we're turning the corner and going back up. So it's a 24 to 26,000 year cycle, depending on a few things, cosmic influences. But we are at the bottom of the darkest of the dark of the Iron Age, and we're just turning the corner and going up again. But just the way as we've passed winter solstice, we're getting a couple of minutes of extra light a day, we start to feel better, because every day there's more light, as opposed to every day there's less light, which was happening a few days ago, and we feel like more and more oppressed. And so we're still being challenged by a number of interference patterns, as you say, but if we're close to water, if we're in nature, if we're away from things that are synthetic and electrostatic, then we can regroup. And so many people have nature deprivation, that they actually don't spend enough time outside, that they're not grounded at all because they live on the 11th floor and work on the 8th floor, walking on cement instead of on the earth, if they even get outside.
Yeah.
And that's really counter counterproductive and counterintuitive to this kind of energy that's elevating us. So we're in really interesting times because there's a lot that's working against us, and then the new energetics are working for us, and we've got to find our way and figure out what enhances these, well, if we want to go that way, but what enhances these kinds of energies and what deters from them.
Yeah, beautifully said. Beautifully said. I have a question about, you were talking about the initiates just a second ago, and I have read and heard, and you've also indicated, that the capstones were engineered, and some have said that they're made out of metals and materials that we do not have here on Earth. Does anybody know what happened to them and when they were removed or what they were
used? Okay, good question. They were going to put a capstone on the Great Pyramid millennium shift. New Year's Eve, 1999, and then, of course, I think that that was just a story, and then they, you know, announced the day before that they didn't get it together. But I don't think that they even had the capacity to put it up there in the first place. I think that the Great Pyramid did start with some kind of a metal capstone. Electrum is one of the... It's a combination of silver and gold and perhaps an unknown substance as well. That the alchemical combination of creates something other than is known on Earth right now. And so it did generate a certain amount of energy, but I think that was a long, long, long time ago, and the Great Pyramid is far, far older than any Egyptologist will tell you. And then there were some circumstances on the planet, and I think that there were, you know, interference patterns in a major way, and I think that... the capstone was removed but put into the etherics. And so one of the things that we're not that conversant about in this day and age is dimensional, just moving between the dimensions and the multiverse instead of the universe. And this is something that the Egyptians really were well-versed in, and they also had the advantage of existing in a golden age where the energy was more refined. And so they were flipping between dimensions and popping in and out here and there and teleporting around, and that was quite normal to them. So the capstone itself, I think, went into the etheric plane, and it was still possible for the high-level initiates to access the energy. Now, what stands right beside this as a concept is the Hall of Records. And so Edgar Cayce talked about it being under the paw of the Sphinx, the left paw.
Right.
And I say beneath, but not below, and meaning that a little bit in front of the left paw and below is the Sphinx Temple. And there are chambers that are underneath there that have been cemented over. So when people think about going and finding the Hall of Records, you're never going to get in there because Zahi Hawass and the Department of Antiquities made sure that they cemented over the top of all of that. So you'd need a fleet of jackhammers to get in there now. But that's not the point, because a lot of people think the Hall of Records is going to be a book in English, leather-bound. And the Egyptians weren't sitting around waiting for English to happen.
Right.
And then, you know, everybody speculates about what could be down there, and I think it is, we found it on the etheric level, and that it's information, it's knowledge, its abilities, it's something that's intangible, but also exists in a higher frequency. And so that's where the capstone is.
Wow. Well, then that would might also indicate that it's safe, and that when we have reached a level that we're capable of using that information without continuing to destroy each other and the planet, perhaps that information could be made accessible without necessarily using a jackhammer, that you can't hide. Yeah, that no matter what attempts are made to hide and conceal the higher information in the etheric realm, it's still there, and it's available when we reach up into, you know, to meet it.
Well, and I've always said, I mean, every dimension passes through the grocery store right now. So some people can be walking through the grocery store in the third dimension, and other people can be in the ninth dimension.
Right. It's, yeah, very
right?
good. I like that. Let's see. Now, when you were in the Sphinx, what? Because I have never heard of this before, but the rooms that you went into that were, let's just say, maybe you weren't supposed to go there exactly. What did you find? What were your experiences as you walked into those rooms? And what did they look like? Can you describe that for us?
Well, you don't walk in.
Okay.
In that they are chambers. There's three different ones, and they all are completely different. So,
Wow. Up
behind the stela, at the heart of the Sphinx, is a trap door, and
Ooh. There's
a small chamber where you actually can climb inside.
Wow.
And it's not big at all. I mean, you can fit a few people in there.
Huh.
You can't stand up in it. And if you leave the trap door open, you look up, and you're looking up the chin of the Sphinx, and it's really quite dramatic because the Sphinx, you know, looks smaller the farther away you are, but it's actually quite a magnificent and large structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the heart. It's the heart, and you know, after
Wow.
a hot day in the summer, it's actually warm, and it actually feels like that you're with the pulse of the Sphinx. So the Sphinx is a very anomalous structure. I mean, it's always felt positively magical to me, and that's one of my favorite places anywhere ever.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of the chambers. Another
okay.
one is on the left rump, and they usually have a grid over that, and you can't get in, and for some reason that was open.
Wow.
And it's a three-story. I think of it as wormholes. Now, of course, you can take a picture and just look at it from a simple standpoint, and it's rocks.
All right.
And they have tampered with it since I was in there. I didn't go into that chamber this time. I wanted to give the opportunity for other people to go in because I had been in and I understand the energy of it.
Mm.
But, you know, they get in there and the workmen start messing around and putting scaffolding and, you know, re-cementing over things, and it changes the original energy of it. And the entirety of the Sphinx, except for one other place, has been quote-unquote restored, which means that other rock has been put over the top of the original material that Sphinx was built out of. And to me, that's where the payload is. It's the real original body of the Sphinx. Now, my experience in there is like it's wormholes in that it spins in a spiral, and it's quite tall. It's three stories high.
Wow.
And so you're actually going up into the body of the Sphinx, but then it can go. You go down toward the left paw. And so most of the passageways that connected to the underground tunnel system have been blocked, and I spent 5 years in and out of those tunnels and holes and seen the extent to which they're blocked, but, you know, it's a good long time since the plateau has functioned the way it did when it was initially constructed. So, inside the body of the Sphinx, to me, is a place where if we experience it at the cellular level, which is basically exposing yourself to it, imprints me in a way that it changes me. So every time I've done it, I haven't slept for 72 hours.
Wow.
And that's three whole days and nights. And I've been, it offered me the possibility of downloading a lot of stuff.
Wow.
And there's another whole process on how that works. And so there's something beyond this world. It's like I've always thought that the presence of the Sphinx and the material that the Sphinx is made out of is not from here. And so by experiencing it, it changes. It changes us at the cellular level. The third chamber is over by the right-hand elbow, if you will. And if you look at pictures of the Sphinx and you're looking at the right-hand side of it, you'll see that there's kind of a box, and it's actually quite high. It's 14 feet high, and it's rounded on the side and then straight up after that, and so it makes it really hard to climb in there because of the shape of it and because of how high it is.
Mm.
But again, I jumped in there too. And what's at stake there is it's the only place on the body of the Sphinx that is original. Okay, when you're inside there, and it's like sand. Like if you touch it, it kind of crumbles.
Huh.
And there were a lot of other chambers, but they were covered. And so if you look at the berets collection of photographs that are now copyright free because they're old enough, you can see the pre-restoration pictures of the Sphinx, and you can see that there's other places that they've covered up that they just, you know, cemented right over where you could have accessed the body of the Sphinx. And so this, to me, that chamber, whatever you want to call it, it's not really a chamber because you're not inside the Sphinx, but you're actually able to feel and be with the original body of the Sphinx, because it's almost like taking a sandcastle and covering it in cement on the beach. So even if it dries up, you know, it's almost like you've made a bucket to catch the sand. But in that particular place, if you touch, well, I touched it by accident, and like a kilo of sand fell off.
Wow.
And so it's incredibly delicate. And so, in essence, what they did is they put the Sphinx in a plastic bag. And so the sweating, and, you know, they had like 80 different scientists decide, you know, what they should do with it, and it cost, you know, bazillions of dollars to restore it, and then actually they just kind of hurt it more than helped it, if you ask me.
Wow.
And then the fourth chamber that exists now is on the top, like right behind the neck. And, of course, you really are not supposed to go up there, and they guard it pretty heavily. But there's a trap door right at the nape of the neck up
have
there.
Have you been
as well.
In there?
I have not been in there, but I've flown over it, seen
okay.
it. So I've flown over it in a helicopter.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And was able to see it. And so Hakim talks about going up there and as a young boy, because, of course, there was no wall around the Giza Plateau at the time. And he and his school chums used to wait for each other when they came home from school, and they'd go play there, because that's like right in the front yard of the home, the family home.
A fascinating person.
I have climbed up the Sphinx, but not up the back.
Okay. Did Hakim share anything from his, you know, he is definitely, or was, he is a master of ancient wisdom. Did he share anything with you that would shed more light for us on the nature of the, you know, that we may not know from public information?
Well, first of all, we joined the first day I met him on the idea that the Sphinx is actually feminine. It's not a masculine artifact. The original name is Tefnuti, which is the spit of the goddess. And that's interesting because Egyptians, you know, don't get creeped out like we do with, you know, different symbols. And it actually was like something coming from the cosmos.
Okay.
And so, and Hakim, like, he's passed, but he's certainly still around. Like, I certainly was aware whenever I'm around the Sphinx or around Abu Ghraib, the crystal altar, he's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And now his son, Joseph, is channeling him. So I've known Joseph since he was a boy.
Wow.
And now he's a grown man, and he never seemed to me to be particularly interested in any of this material. And then since his father died, he seems to be really taking it to heart. And so he was with us at Abusir and showing us how the power plant used to work and how, you know, the water used to flow and what everything was for and how, you know, it really was a series of power generation devices and superior technology.
Uh-huh.
And so he's going on and he's talking and everything. And then at the end I said, Joseph, it seems to me like you're saying more than you know. Like, are you aware of that? And he goes, I know. Every time I talk, more comes out. And
wow.
I said, well, you know what's happening. And he says, well, I think I know what's happening. I said, well, you're channeling your father.
Right.
But then beyond that, I think he's channeling what his father can see from the other side.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And it is unbelievable because Hakim took me to all those places. I mean, I studied with him.
Yeah.
My mentor for 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm telling you, like, he is as alive and well on the other side as can be, and it's really quite something. So not only did he teach me as a, you know, he's a pretty tough taskmaster.
Oh, yeah.
I probably said this to you before, that he wouldn't tell me anything unless I already knew it.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I'd go seeking and searching and looking, and then I'd come back and say, does this and this and this and this, and then he'd start telling me. He goes, yeah, now you get it. I'll talk to you about it. It's like, why didn't you just tell me before?
Right.
But that's not the kind of teacher he was.
Right.
And so, you know, he was a really interesting person to hang out with, I'll tell you that. And we spent a lot of time in the National Museum going around and explaining, like, one wing at a time.
Wow.
And so he really, really gave me an education in the museum, I'll tell you that. And having him all to myself to explain, you know, what went where and, even how museums are supposed to function. And there's a lot of problems in the National Museum, I'll tell you.
Yes.
I went in there for the first time in 1977, and at the time, if you spent 1 minute at every exhibit, you'd be in there for 9 months.
Wow.
Well, the whole thing has been decimated. They've ripped, you know, cases right off the wall, and they've closed whole rooms. And I'm here to tell you that since the Mubarak defeat, half of what used to be in the National Museum, well, not since the defeat, since I was in there in 77,
mm-hmm.
half of it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But since Mubarak left, an awful lot of stuff's been hauled out of there. And it's covered, a lot of things are covered in plastic. So Hakim would come with me when I led groups starting
mm-hmm.
in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd do the museum visit, and he would describe things. And then I've done the same thing since he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I take a few steps and go to describe an artifact, and it would be gone. And then take a few more steps and go to describe another artifact, and it's gone.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. And they're just, you know, they had a, for example, a Hatshepsut display at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And for the first time since Hatshepsut was alive, from the 18th dynasty, all her statues were together. And they were all found together, 28 statues, you know, thrown into a pit and mostly broken. But because all the pieces were there, they were restored.
Uh-huh.
But these artifacts were all over the world, and quite a few of them were in the National Museum in Egypt. And, you know, since that exhibit in March of 2009, the statues never went back to Cairo.
Oh. Wow.
It's awful.
Wow.
Because we don't know where they are, and they're being sold on the black market.
Yeah.
So in the days when Mubarak was not stepping down and it was being demanded, I think that an awful lot of stuff was wholesaled out of there. And they, you know, CNN really wants everybody to think that it was the people that went in, and they had a stage thing, and they filmed and they showed people, you know, like it was Hollywood. And
yeah.
it had nothing to do with the people.
It
I'm sure of it.
It never does. It's always
it never does. They always make it look, and even the
right.
you know, in the streets and the looting and all that stuff, that was plainclothes Mubarak people that were doing that.
Yeah.
So it's upsetting, and Hakim used to insist, he'd repeat to me over and over, nothing can be lost.
Right.
Like, what do you mean? What do you mean? I mean, they got out of Egypt. Everything should come back to Egypt. And he's like, maybe not. Maybe if people can't go back to Egypt or won't go back to Egypt, if these artifacts end up in museums, that they can experience what it is, and it doesn't have to be in Egypt.
That's right.
And, I thought about that inside my head. What do you mean nothing can be lost? What do you mean? And, in fact, energetically, if it once existed, the imprint of it is still there energetically. We need to access it.
Absolutely.
In a different way.
Absolutely. And there is an etheric double. Which of everything. So at the very least, there is a pristine version that exists on the etheric plane. So we need to do our spiritual homework and move within on the inner plane so that we can access all of that, all of what is, all that is, that is no longer in 3D, while people rape and pillage and steal and burn and throw on wars and the rest of it just for... amusement. You mentioned something interesting. You used the words "not from here," and I know that we haven't really gotten into this too much in the past. But you're also working on a book, a couple of books, and one of them has to do with the extraterrestrial connection, which it really cannot be denied. It's right in our face. Can you tell us a little bit about your own experiences with that and what will be in your book and how's that coming along?
Okay, the book is called Aliens in Ancient Egypt.
Oh, yes.
Close Encounters and Secrets of an Owl Civilization.
All right.
And the writing deadline's January 15th, so I've been fingers to the keyboard now for a while.
Okay.
And so it's going through mostly... the Amarna period, the 18th dynasty,
uh-huh.
and the descended skulls, Nefertiti, Akhenaten, their daughter, King Tut, and the anomalies that they represented. But also, within these descended skulls, there was room for an enlarged pineal gland. And the pineal gland is shaped like a pine cone, and you've got the court of the pine cone at the Vatican, and it really is the gland, whatever, that connects us to our spiritual higher beings, higher selves. And I've got past life memory from that period of time, including the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut, which is earlier in that dynasty. So the entirety of the 18th dynasty, they're talking about, even Hatshepsut was said that her father was kind of taken over by a high-level being and impregnated her mother, and therefore she's starseed. Well, there's a lot of discrepancy in terms of the family trees from any of the dynasties, and the more research I do, the more I think that every author is just making stuff up. And if you, you know, the more you read, the more, you know, if you look up, you know, the family tree, you know, in 18 websites, you're going to find 18 trees. Like, pretty much nobody knows how it went. So I think that, you know, I subscribe to the notion of psychic archaeology, that you get a you get a hunch from at the cellular level from maybe cellular memory, past life memory, and then go and verify it in the field. It's not that we're not scientific, but I think that the ideas may come from another realm. And so I'm pretty sure that Hatshepsut and Nefertiti, Tut, Akhenaten were starseed. From another planetary realm, and I think they had the ability to be popping in and out between dimensions. And so, you know, there's all kinds of evidence showing up now of technology that they had, and wormholes and stargates and that sort of thing. And we have looked at them through patriarchal eyes. And the other thing that I see over and over again is this medical model that we want to diagnose everybody and see them as, you know, sick, retarded, deformed, you know, low zinc, radiated. You know, like, the more you read about this, you know, the more they're just, like, you know, throwing ideas at the wall and letting them slide down kind of thing. Like, it doesn't add up because they're barking up the wrong tree, if you ask me. So my conviction with this book is to really look at how this alien connection would have worked, who they were, why they were here, how they were popping into a deteriorating society. So it's almost like they had the secrets of the Golden Age, and they were bringing it back during, like, all of the Egyptian dynasties are patriarchal. So the first dynasty corresponded to the beginning of the Mayan calendar, 3113 BC. And it's fascinating that the Mayan calendar would be represented and make sense in Egypt as well. But, you know, they so if in the Golden Age they had these abilities and possibly lots of contact with off-planet material as well and beings, and then it got denser and denser and denser and denser as the Iron Age came upon us and as the patriarchal ways of being and thinking came upon us, and warring and power over and overtaxation and all that kind of stuff that we've got now. There were a few periods of time, notably, in the 18th dynasty, in the Hatshepsut era, and in the Nefertiti and Akhenaten era, which followed with Tut, where this spirituality was percolating back up. And it was completely misunderstood. And, you know, the Amun priesthood was rivaling them at the time, at the Amarna period, and gaining strength all the way from Hatshepsut's day. And they were making it religious instead of spiritual, and you had to pay for your salvation instead of being personally empowered to understand it yourself. And so we really haven't had peace since that time. And we're still, you know, in the same vein as the Amun priesthood, and we still say amen at the end of the prayer. You know, and it's still, it's the remnants of them are still upon us, deteriorating or trying to deteriorate any kind of true spirituality in the name of my God's better than your God. Bang, you're dead. And I get a profit from it.
Absolutely.
Not me, but you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah, well, we could do a whole show on that one. But I think it's enough just to sit back and watch all of that unravel, because I think people are reaching a point, and will reach a point in the very near future, when those things will be obvious and our telepathic abilities will start to come online again.
Well, yes, imagine if everybody was telepathic and they could tell when a politician was lying, which is pretty much all the time.
All the time.
Right, and like people expect to be lied to, and you know, like
right.
What did Hitler say? The bigger the lie, and the more often you repeat it, the more people will believe it.
Absolutely, absolutely, no question about that. Your book is coming out in January. I can't wait to read it, and I'm gonna want you back on the show to talk about it after I've read it, because this is gonna be a wonderful one. Are you going to include a lot of the information that we've been talking about here? The decades of wisdom that you've garnered from all of these ancient sites and your own intuitive aspects and from Hakim and the rest, will some of that be in there as well?
Yeah, and it's the writing deadline's January 15th. It's got to go through the editing process and
then the
printing process. So it'll be printed in May. It should be on the shelves in June.
Wonderful.
I'm actually writing a second book, so between the two of them, a lot of this information will be in there.
Well, yes,
but of course not everything, because you can't put everything between covers, for sure.
Right, right.
I mean, it just doesn't fit.
Now, you're doing another book. Go ahead.
The second book is called Lost Keys of the Sacred Feminine, Decoding Dendera. And that's actually going to be a video book, an online project, and I'm doing that with William Henry. And he's all about the elixir, the oil of enlightenment that they had, and the stargates, and then we're looking at the newly cleaned ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, which is a veritable star map, and it's got a whole story up there, and it's absolutely incredible. It's about 40 feet up, and it's the entirety of the first hypostyle hall, and it used to be, when you looked at it, you were looking into a cup of black coffee, and you couldn't see what was underneath, and they're not allowed to add color and paint when they restore something in Egypt, but they are allowed to take off fungus and soot, if you will. Because a lot of the Christians in the 3rd century, 2nd and 3rd century, were, you know, using, if you can believe it, they were using the temples like stables, and they were burning the dung in there, if you can believe it.
Oh, good Lord. I believe that. That makes sense.
And so a lot, you know, it just started this terrible process that deteriorated all these secrets that were underneath. So it's the last time I was there, I got to see the left side of the hypostyle hall that didn't have the scaffolding in it anymore. So, you know, I don't think anybody's really tackled this, and ancient writers wouldn't have been able to see it. You know, if they were writing anything other than the last few years. And so the other thing, though, is when you look at it, I mean, it's quite an undertaking to want to decipher it, because you look at it and it's like, well, what is all this stuff?
Right.
You know, animal-headed beings and, you know, two-headed rams with wings. But it's there. I mean, it's speaking to the processional cycle, and all the secrets and the symbolism is there. It's just that we have, you know, not had the toolkit, to decipher it. And then there's been all these ways that, you know, hieroglyphic has been interpreted wrongly.
Uh-huh.
Like, to me, the audacity of taking 4,000 Egyptian symbols and our 26 letters and saying, this is an A, this is a B. They weren't waiting for us. It has nothing to do with our alphabet.
That's right. That's right.
Right? And so people get their name written in hieroglyphic. It's like, something like that.
You know? Right.
So there's still a lot of secrets out there, but it's coming together. And one of the things that I find fascinating, going back to Egypt so many times, and the other thing is I've been photographing it for a long time, including in the museum, and you're not allowed to photograph in there anymore, but I've got photographs from years ago, which is how I know the artifacts as well as I do, and I can tell what's missing and what's been moved, which you're not supposed to do. But, you know, I learn more about symbols. I see more every time I'm there. And I was standing at Kamumbo looking at a wall that I've looked at many, many times, and all of a sudden, it's like the whole thing came alive, and I understood what I was looking at. It's like, I don't understand how that works. You know, I've read a lot of the books, and, you know, my stomach's turned, and I nearly pass out because there's something wrong with what I'm looking at.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and then I kind of go back to Egypt and discover more, and then read the book again and still feel a little faint, but there's little crumbs in it. You know what I mean? Like
we're searching
around for little crumbs to try to put this picture back together, and then getting huge hits of intuition, and then suddenly whole chunks of it just make sense. And part of that's energetic.
Yes.
Part of that's just, you know, fastidiousness and sticking with it and continuing to open and then little clues that other people are discovering as well. And it's like the whole picture is still kind of being unpacked, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I'm really pleased that it's worth going back and that, you know, there's more of me to decipher it. And every little bit, you know, adds to this incredible deciphering of the biggest mystery we've got.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, what I have had the experience where I've seen the, it looks like hieroglyphs, and it's layers of dimensionality that move out of the physical world, and they're just basically floating on top of everything, and there are these symbols, and they look like hieroglyphics. And I suppose if I had time to read them, I would be able to grasp something or get something intuitively from it, but that they're there. And so I'm guessing that this is a multidimensional experience, that those vibrations are fields that you can perceive and grasp, but not with your mind.
Well, thank you for that. And what's true about Egyptian artifacts, frescoes, symbols, and temples and pyramids is that they are so precisely engineered that a temple will represent the cavities of a human body.
Mm-hmm.
Interference
mm-hmm.
patterns go rampant when people are, take my picture, me, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And ignorant and not respectful or reverent in any way. But the minute that a temple clears, it resets, almost like rebooting a computer, instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something about the dimensionality and the architecture that is also playing on us, on our psyches, on our bodies.
Yes.
And so, we're perceiving it with much more than our eyes and our physical senses. So, but what you just said about getting these codes, I've stumbled upon something here that explains why when you have visions that it doesn't necessarily mean that you understand what they are.
Right.
If you want me to get into that, I can explain that a little bit.
Would you?
Okay, so one of the things, and I haven't heard this anywhere, it's just something that came to me, and it came to me from experiences within the Sphinx.
Okay.
And from these codes that I was downloading after when I wouldn't sleep, the 72 hours after being inside the Sphinx.
Yes.
So the metaphor, okay, first of all, we have 11 codons on the front of our body and 11 on the back, which means each person carries 22. But when there are 66, so when there's three people present, then some of this stuff can get unpacked. So here's the process. It's the metaphor is a computer program. So when you download the codes, it's comparable to downloading a computer program. Well, once you download it, some people download programs, they don't even know where they go, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can't find them, and they didn't install the program.
Right.
But they downloaded it.
Mm-hmm.
So what? What do you got? Nothing, except a downloaded file somewhere that you can't find. So then the next step is to install the program. So you do your process with that. Well, you still don't have anything. You have to open the program and use it to create something.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So it's a three-stage process. And another metaphor would be going and getting groceries. Well, you don't have a meal. You've got groceries. So you bring them in, then you've got to put them away. Then you've got to cook the meal.
Right.
Then you've got a meal.
Right.
And so you've got to unpack and prepare and use before you get anything. So what I'm finding is that if one person downloads a bunch of codes, they sit there dormant, but if you get into a high state by being around the body of the Sphinx and you're in the company of three people, 66 codons, all of a sudden the wisdom starts to come out and nobody knows where it's coming from. And I say it's coming from the downloaded codes, and there has to be enough surface area, if you will, or energy, or RAM, random access memory, or whatever, capacity, which happens with more than one person. So none of this stuff with the high-level initiates is a one-person show. It's always a group field that's bigger than the one person, the lower self surrendering to the higher self in the company of other people doing the same thing.
Wow.
That's when the codes get unpacked.
Wow. And you've had that experience probably many times, haven't you? And specifically this time?
Over and over.
And
over and over.
What's
been a long haul.
Before we have to start thinking about the end of the show, and it just seems like this has flown by, Is there anything that you'd particularly like to share with us that was particularly moving or poignant, or something that you would like to, share from this last trip?
Well, we did have the possibility of doing a horse and camel ride during the full moon as well, earlier that day.
Uh-huh.
And there were anomalies on the moon, and people experienced it in different ways. Some people didn't notice a thing. I noticed that the moon was all one color, and it didn't seem like a gradient fill that was reflecting off the sun that had just set.
Uh-huh.
It was just like this dull orange, and it was all one shade, and I was riding a horse. I kept riding, galloping up to the front and galloping back so I could watch the moon some more.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ladies was looking into another dimension, and she saw a pentagram on the moon.
Wow.
And the five-sided figure. And then there were two people who had iPhones who had a Star Walk application. And they, if you hold the iPhone up to a constellation, it'll tell you what it is. Well, they were putting it up to the moon, and the iPhone seemed to be malfunctioning. And they decided that there was some kind of a portal that the moon was covering. And they
wow.
were all spooked, these people who saw these sorts of things, and they came to me individually and kind of went, something happened. We don't really know what we're looking at, but this is what we think. And so anomalies on the moon, whatever we mean by that, is something that's kind of rolling around in there for an explanation, looking for an explanation.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of exciting stuff opening up right now, Carmen. A lot, and you certainly have opened more doors for us to think about and expand our thought forms and look into. Before we go, would you share with us where people can find the Pyramid Code and your works, and also about the Evolver Intensive?
EvolverIntensive.com is how you can access the course. It's also linked on my website. Everything's connected to PyramidCode.com. Under order, you'll find everywhere you can get the Pyramid Code, Amazon, all those typical channels. It's in European versions as well.
Mm-hmm.
And information about the upcoming 12-12 trip is there. The program's confirmed. It's from December 8th to 22nd, and 2012. And so everything's there on the website.
Wonderful. And I'm part of the Evolver Intensive, and I just want to say it is an incredible experience. You have to experience it. It doesn't cost much. You can just join for one or all of them. And I believe there are two more, one left with Christopher Dunn and with William Henry. So there's going to be a volume of information coming through. And I think it's a terrific way to experience this information directly and get to speak with the guests as well.
Yeah. And I'll be doing more courses through interactive-theletteru.com, which is building, but it isn't launched yet.
Okay.
And that'll be a series of online courses. So.
Wonderful. Well, Carmen, this has been a fantastic show. I can't thank you enough for coming back to share your wisdom with us. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay. Thanks, Lance, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you, too, and everybody listening. All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.